Saul Friedlander was born in Prague just before Hitler came to power, and he spent his childhood during the Nazi era running and hiding in order to stay alive. As an adult, he has dedicated his life to understanding that era and is a leading authority on the rise of Hitler and the Holocaust. It's a subject of renewed interest now as far-right sentiments surge in popularity not only in Europe but also here in the United States. Mr. Friedlander published a memoir, When Memory Comes, in 1978. It's just been re-released by Other Press, along with his latest book, a second memoir, Where Memory Leads. I'm very pleased that they bring him to our show today. Welcome.
Thank you.
You're best known for your scholarly historical works. How did it feel to dig into your own past to write these memoirs?
Well, it's not intentional, really. It was a need in 78, in any case. I constantly rehashed, if I may say, what led me to the scholarly work, that is my own experience, without really being aware of it very clearly. And I wrote then with difficulty, I must say, but I wrote When Memory Comes. And 40 years later, at a somewhat advanced age, I decided to close the circle and to see how the past, or to show how the past impacts on the whole life.
You mentioned at the outset that you're concerned about your own memory. Are you afraid of forgetting important things as you get older?
Afraid? I forget.
So you have to research what happened in your own life?
Well, not in, you know, long memory or long-term memory works well. It's the immediate, what's your name, by the way?
Yeah, well, in your case, I could ask that question because you changed your name.
Yeah, many times.
But you were born with a different first name?
Yes, Pavel in Prague.
Paul.
And Paul in France. Mm-hmm. In Pavel in Prague, which the diminutive is Pavlicek. And then arrived in Paris, 39, Paul. Arrived and hid in a monastery, were hidden, yeah. At the age of 10, Paul-Henri-Marie Ferland. Friedlander disappeared. Mm-hmm. And then when I was taken out and made my way to Israel in 48, I became Shaul, which is the, you know, from Saul to Paul, and from Paul, in my case, back to Saul. Shaul is the Hebrew for Saul.
How did your family identify? As Jewish, Czech, German, European?
I never had a chance to ask them, but I would say, from what I know about them, from what I read, that they were essentially culturally German. But my mother was a Zionist. Strangely enough, all my uncles were Zionists. But my father was, I think, very much anti-Zionist.
How old? Yeah, go ahead.
You know,
which
that
was,
is
which
the
was
kind
not
of
unusual
Central
the
European,
that...
German-speaking, Jewish community.
How old were you when your parents fled Prague?
How old I was?
Yeah.
6 and a half.
And you went to France?
Yeah.
But weren't you baptized as a Catholic in France?
Yeah.
Was but that to save you?
That's not the same time. We came to France when the Germans occupied Bohemia Moravia. Slovakia remained so-called independent. We thought that France was sure that there was secure, that there was no... no problem of German attack on France or occupation, of course not. And my uncles, though, went to Palestine. And my grandmother and one of her sons went to Sweden. So you see, the whole family went to pieces. And, of course, in 1940, as we were living in Paris, the Germans were at the gates of Paris. So we fled to the center, to the south of France. And there, the Germans started arresting the foreign Jews first, and then they would take the French. we were foreign Jews. We had no nationality. We were by then apatride, as they would say in France. And my parents first put me in a Jewish children's home. And a few hours after I was put there, the French police arrived, took all the kids above 10. So as I was 10 minus a few weeks, I wasn't taken. So immediately back to where we lived and then into a Catholic boarding house.
Were you baptized?
Yes, and then I was baptized.
Some years ago, I interviewed a young woman who had been sent to a convent. And after the war was over, she had a serious readjustment problem because people told her she was Jewish. But in her mind, she was a good Catholic girl.
Yeah, so was I.
Same thing happened.
Yeah, it took me a year. I was an adolescent when I came out, almost 14. And, you know, the changes of adolescence. So I abandoned my Catholicism, in quotes, I would say 7-8 months after. I became a communist for 3 months. Because after 3 months, you know, I was asked to sell the Humanité, which is the communist newspaper in France, or was the most important. But I didn't, as I am very shy, I would sell the paper like pornographic pictures. So, and then I became a Zionist.
When was the last time you saw your parents?
Exactly in the mid-September 1942, I knew they were hiding at the hospital in the town where I was put as a boarder in the Catholic. So I fled that place. I was 10 then. And reached the hospital. Now, what I don't know to this very day is how I knew that and which name they were there. They were not under their own name. But I found them. And my father had to call back the seminary, and two nuns came and took me away. That was the last time I saw them.
My guest is Saul Friedlander, whose latest book is his second memoir, Where Memory Leads. It is published by Other Press. So after the war, you decided to leave school as a teenager and go to Israel. And that's when you say you decided to change your name. Do you remember your first impressions of Israel?
Well, of course.
Well, this is before Israel became an independent.
No, it was 2 weeks later.
So 1948?
I was present at the big manifestation in honor of Israel, of the birth of Israel in May 1948. I was at the place in Paris where everybody gathered. There were so many people that the podium crashed. And 2 weeks later, I was a fervent Zionist by then because I read every paper about the battles and so on. So I got on an illegal ship. It was illegal because it belonged to the Irgun, which was a right-wing, a Begin's movement.
And you joined Betar.
I joined Betar.
Which was the youth group from Irgun. Yeah. So you went from being a communist to being a very right-wing Zionist.
But I had no idea, no idea of what they wanted. And when I was called for an interview, the only one I had, they asked me, what do we want? But somebody had told me before what I should answer. I said, both of the sides of the Jordan. But I didn't know what the Jordan meant and what both shores of the Jordan meant.
Well, were you trying to figure out who you were? You also had to change your age and forge an ID card. And you were confused a bit about religion. And now you're making a major commitment to the Jewish cause in Israel.
Right. To the Jewish cause, but I would
say in a very idealistic way.
Yes, not the Jewish cause as represented nowadays by our government.
In fact, you write that today Israel is no little boy anymore. He has turned into a defiant adolescent who still doesn't hesitate to pee on the shoes of his protector against much of the world.
That's true.
Is that a criticism of Benjamin Netanyahu?
And how? I refer here to a cartoon which was published 20 or 30 years ago when there was another crisis with the U.S., and the cartoon published in Israel was showing a little boy, which was Israeli, with this typical hat, which makes you look a little bit foolish. The big Uncle Sam is standing next to the little boy and giving him a bunch of dollars. The boy with one hand takes the money, with the other hand he directs his peeing on the shoes of the Uncle Sam. So I say today it's not a little boy anymore, but...
And you've become an outspoken critic of current Israeli policies, especially regarding the settlements in the occupied territories. How prevalent is that position in Israel today? There was a time when the country seemed to be almost split 50-50. Is that still true?
It's very difficult to answer your question. I listen to the news from Israel every day, so I follow every little event. But my sense of things is that it is still politically almost 50-50. A lot depends on where the religious parties, with whom they're ready to make an alliance. And as the right, Likud and further right, are ready to give them much more than the left, they simply create a coalition with the right which is stronger than the left.
And right now we're hearing loud calls for an end to this two-state solution.
I don't know if these are loud calls, but now that
members of the government.
Yeah, but now that Trump is the president-elect, they know, Netanyahu and his allies, that they have the backing of the next U.S. Government.
After you left Betar, you began working for Nahum Goldman, the president of the World Jewish Congress and the World Zionist Organization. What kind of work were you doing for him?
Oh, I was his... He called it political secretary, but really I was taking care of meeting the people he didn't want to meet, in New York in particular, and then in Jerusalem. We were traveling New York, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, New York, and I was writing letters and so on. I was doing menial work.
You write that many people in Ashkenazi Israeli society were unconsciously racist toward the Arabs in Israel, and also toward Jewish immigrants from North Africa and Yemen.
Absolutely.
Do these attitudes continue to have an influence on Israeli politics?
I think it had a crucial influence on Israeli politics in the sense that those discarded masses of immigrants from North Africa, less so from Yemen and Iraq, there were lesser numbers, but a lot from Morocco, Tunisia and Algeria, they became disenchanted, they became resentful, and ultimately the politician who knew how to catch their anger, and we know a little bit about this here now, was Menachem Begin, and the elections of 77 changed the whole picture. That is, Begin, the head of the ex-Irgun and what was to become the Likud, the names changed, Herut at the time, was elected prime minister.
Because before then it was pretty much Ben-Gurion's
vision
of Israel.
It was Ben-Gurion and his kind of socialism.
What was Goldman's role in immigration into Israel at the time that you were working for him?
Well, Goldman was both head of the World Jewish Congress and of the World Zionist Organization. He was really the central person in the diaspora for those who were at all interested in those issues. He was in charge, theoretically, of encouraging immigration from wherever, the communist countries. That was very difficult. And from North Africa, which was easier, but he didn't really perceive, as far as I can say today, the problems that were being created in Israel by a mass immigration and by a kind of mass, not rejection, but let's say distancing from these immigrants.
Well, there was a certain amount of racial tension when Ethiopian Jews were airlifted into Israel, when they were threatened in Ethiopia. When did you come to the United States? So were you surprised by the racial issues that you saw here in those days?
Not in those days. I followed. I was here during the 60s and so on. So I saw what was going
on. The civil rights movement.
But, you know, I was fixated on what was going on in Israel. And so I was passive here.
Many people claim that there's a pervasive anti-Israeli bias in universities in the United States. Some see it as anti-Semitic. Did you experience that as a graduate student or as an academic?
No, no, not. I was a graduate student in political science in Paris in the 50s.
Ah.
So we speak of today. Today I experienced it as a teacher at UCLA, where I am now retired. But it's becoming more and more pervasive.
When people in this country talk about seeing similarities between what went on in Europe in the 30s and what's going on here right now, there is a book by Volker Ulrich, the first volume of his biography of Hitler, that and a review in the Times that kind of made saw parallels between Hitler and Trump. I don't think Donald Trump is an Adolf Hitler.
No.
But do you see some of the things happening here, or is this a unique situation?
No, Trump is no Hitler. Trump is, how did Bloomberg call him? A con man. A con man and something of a foolish guy. And who doesn't seem to know a lot about things that he should know in this position. Hitler was an ideologist, a fanatical, obsessed ideologist, which Trump doesn't seem... Trump is a demagogue who takes whatever works, but it's not... it has not the same obsession that Hitler had, and he doesn't use... political violence on the streets, which Hitler used. And I would say that those who voted for him are angry people, I'm sure. But this is not Weimar in the 20s.
Although supporters of Donald Trump will argue that using words like demagogue and bigot are insulting to them.
Well, maybe. what can you do in politics? Sometimes you have to insult to be on the right side.
Saul Friedlander will be doing an interview, taking questions, and signing books tomorrow at 8 p.m. at the Columbia University Institute for Israel and Jewish Studies. That's at 1140 Amsterdam Avenue. And then on Wednesday, he will be speaking at the Museum of Jewish Heritage at 7 p.m. That's at 36 Battery Place. No more histories from you?
Histories? Well, I'm thinking of some, but, you know, I'm 84.
And you've written quite a bit of history.
Yes.
Is the process totally different?
But mostly about the Shoah, about the Holocaust, mostly.
And this book is the second memoir from Saul Friedlander. It's called Where Memory Leads. It is published by Other Press, and... it has been a great pleasure having you on our show today.
It was
Thank
a pleasure.
So
Thank you very much.